It's a great privilege for me to be here with you, and greetings from the Adventist world of education. Altogether, we have over 8,000 Seventh-day Adventist schools that are part of the yearbook, the organized work of the church, over 100,000 teachers, and we are educating nearly 2 million students, just shy of 2 million students. And I just was in Brazil with 2,000 very enthusiastic Brazilian teachers. It's wonderful to see how the church embraces the work of education there and supports it very directly. Where the church supports the work of education, we have a young church. And where we distance ourselves from the work of education, the church ages. So I was glad to be there, and I'm glad to be here as well. I'm going to be sharing with you from a presentation that has had a lot of challenges, there we go, on learning from work. Why do we, as the Seventh-day Adventist Church, offer education? First and foremost, it is to redeem and restore the image of God in students and to prepare them for service in this world and the greater joy of service in the world to come. And we all know this quote, but this is key for our philosophy and why we should have work. This past annual council, 2016, the annual council, which is the General Conference Executive Committee, about close to 500 people from around the world are there annually to conduct business of the church, such as to vote changes to General Conference working policy, to vote new appointments, and so on. In 2016, the special theme for 2 days before the annual council begins was on education, Adventist education. And they voted during annual council 10 objectives to strengthen education. Objective number eight pertains directly to the work you are doing here at ESAE and in your organizations. And I'll just read it. The vote was to authorize the General Conference Education Department in collaboration with the World Divisions and as a quinquennial priority to develop a guiding philosophy and a worldwide regionally responsive plan for SDA education to be approved by the 2017 annual council, and it needed to include 10 objectives. Objective number 8 relates to your work. That is to develop educational resources, support, and or standards for other models of education, such as homeschools, residence hall, non-degree awarding colleges, innovative educational centers of influence in both urban and rural settings, pastoral-led classes, massive open online courses, etc., in a way that enables such students to be part of Seventh-day Adventist education. I told you about the organized work of the church, over 8,000 schools, over 100,000 teachers who are on our payroll, and nearly 2 million. But Adventist education is not about buildings, schools, and payroll. It's a philosophy. And so Objective 8 expands that umbrella. How can we expand Adventist education outside of our schools through resources? One of the strengths of the work in Brazil is how the publishing house has embraced education. They develop learning resources for every level. They develop textbooks. They even have puppets and toys and TV programs. They employ about 20 graphic designers there in the publishing house to do animations and to develop things that this generation understands. And some of these resources are purchased by non-Adventist school systems as well. So that's one example. In Mongolia and in a few other places in the world, such as Concepcion, Chile, the church there has purchased a home where university students who are studying on a public, and in fact, I believe near Chattanooga, there was Advent House. I don't know if it's still operational, but university students on a public campus, Seventh-day Adventist students, can live there. In Mongolia, they remodel part of the mission compound. It was the Sabbath school, I think women's ministry area. They actually knocked out the walls and they made a dormitory in which students can live, because Ulaanbaatar has about 100 universities and colleges, and students can live there right in the Union compound. We don't have our own school, but this is a way to mentor and to disciple these young people, the majority of whom are non-Adventists. This year, I just received an email. They are only having women, female students, because of just human resources. That's what they can manage. Earlier, they had both young men and young women, but now it's just young university women, and they're discipling them. So that's what is meant by a non-degree college. Also, some things are needed right in cities. If you look at the distribution of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, we are disproportionately a rural church. We need to work the cities as well. And education is a means by which we can do that, from daycare, early childhood education, through some of these residence halls near a great university, New York City and Columbia University or other places. We can have a presence by using education. Of course, online education is another means of doing that, but we need to broaden the scope of Adventist education. And that is something that the worldwide church has discussed, set as a priority, and we've had a series of four regional conferences for all of the divisions in which we reviewed these eight objectives and identified ways by which we could achieve that. The first conference was, the first one was held in Rwanda for the three divisions in Africa. The second was held in Slovenia. And I don't see Marius right here now. I'm sure he'll be coming soon. But we had that for all of Europe as well as North America. That they joined there, and the Middle East, North Africa region. The third set of conferences were held in Inter-American Division. And this is just for the leadership of the church, union presidents, university, and college presidents, union education directors, and in some cases, we've also had principals of high schools and conference education directors studying these on how can we do a better job of using education to achieve the mission of the church. And the last set of conferences that we just concluded was last week in Bangkok. So I actually went from Bangkok to Brazil, Brazil to here. But we had about 250 that met in Bangkok for Northern Asia-Pacific Division, Southern Asia-Pacific Division, and part of Middle East, North Africa. These are the regions of the world and South Pacific Division that have huge non-Christian populations. Half of the Southern Asia-Pacific Division is Muslim. The largest population of Muslims outside of the Middle East is in Indonesia. All of China and much of Asia, Buddhist or atheistic, and then India, Hindu faith, and some Muslims as well. And education allows us to do a work we could not do in any other way. It's very difficult to do evangelism, and certainly not public evangelism, in a Muslim country, but we can open schools, we can do educational work. So the work you're doing is part and a welcome part of the global strategic plan. Now, let's just step back from what our aspirations are, what we want to do as a church, to what the demographic realities are. We're close to 20 million Seventh-day Adventists around the world now, but this is based on data when we were about 18 million. Globally, based on global surveys, the percentage of Seventh-day Adventists who have some Adventist education is less than half, 47% only have some, whereas the majority of Seventh-day Adventists, 52%, have no Seventh-day Adventist education at all. In fact, I should stop and do a little quiz. Who could tell me what the first Seventh-day Adventist school is? First Seventh-day Adventist school. Okay, good, Lo Harper Bell. Okay, well, our first college was Battle Creek College, but our first school was the Sabbath School. And it's still our oldest school. And I mean that quite seriously, because our forefathers believed that the Lord was coming very soon, and we did not establish schools early on. Our pioneers felt that all resources needed to be put in to proclaiming the midnight cry. And literature work took the forefront of proclaiming this word. It was not until Ellen White was given a vision in which she, after that, said, we must have a school. And Battle Creek College followed that. Early believers did some homeschooling. There were some primary school efforts in which somebody might have been employed. But the Sabbath school was the means by which our forefathers were nurtured into present truth. And actual schools came much later. And so at least our membership still is going to Sabbath school, but formal education, less than half at any level. When you look at the distribution of membership, and this doesn't include all the divisions, but I'll name them, East Central Africa Division, less than half. And you were, Dr. Cavanaugh, you worked there in that division when you were in Rwanda. Less than half have any Adventist education at all. Inter-American Division, over 70%. That's the largest division, that in South America. North American Division is doing the best. And we've had the longest time. But even here, just a little over 25% of our membership have 25% have no Adventist education. South American Division, 60%. South Africa Indian Ocean Division, 75%. Three out of every four have no Adventist education. South Pacific Division, doing a little bit better, just under half. Southern Asia Pacific Division, a little over half. And as I mentioned, half of the membership in that division are Muslim. Not they're Muslim, but their territory, the population in that region, half are Muslim. Trans-European Division, a little bit better. And West Central Africa Division, nearly 70%. So this variability, what you see from here is that divisions where the church is growing rapidly, such as South Africa Indian Ocean Division, the one, the tallest bar, the greatest growth is there, was at this period, but the fewest members. And that is because new converts are coming into the church with no experience in Adventist education. And this is causing a concern in what Seventh-day Adventist believes. We have seen an increasing diversity of views on the fundamental doctrines of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Adventists are clear about the Sabbath, and they're clear about the Second Coming. But from there is falling off of a whole range of things, and some of the areas where there's a great deal of diversity is, for example, State of the Dead. Seventh-day Adventists who are not clear about what happens when somebody dies. Never mind doctrines like the investigative judgment, which is even lower. And you can understand why. They're new converts. They've had Mark Finley or some other mass evangelism, and the doctrines went by quickly. They come into the church, but they are not grounded in it. And there's another reason why, when you look at what experiences with Adventist education our pastors have. Years of Adventist education for the church's pastors. Global survey shows that 26% have had less than 4 years of Seventh-day Adventist education. And this isn't showing the number there, I'm not quite sure, but the majority, let's see, it's 1 to 4, oh no, it's 5 to 9 is the larger one, 9 to 12 years of Adventist education, only 16%. Those with 13 or more years, is that, can somebody have better eyes than I? Yeah, 14%, thank you. And those with no Adventist education are all 8%. So 8 out of 100 pastors have had no Adventist education whatsoever, not even their seminary. The 1 to 4 represents, for the most part, their Bachelor of Theology degree. But there are pastors who have had no Adventist education. So no wonder the congregations themselves are not clear about the 28 fundamental beliefs beyond Jesus is coming back again in the Sabbath. For this reason, we at the General Conference have voted 4 priorities for education. And the first is Adventist identity and mission in the work of Adventist education. This is a challenge in some places where we look very much like other schools in terms of our goals. The government curriculum is used, and increasingly around the world, we are employing people of other faith or no faith at all as our teachers, and increasingly, we are admitting to our programs non-Adventist children. These two metrics are going down together, or up together. The number of non-Adventist students is increasing, the number of non-Adventist teachers is increasing, and you already saw the data for the pastors. The next is to increase student access. Around the world, the percentages vary, but far too many Seventh-day Adventist students are studying in other schools, public campuses, sometimes other private. And it's not just money. I was vice president at Loma Linda University for 8 years, and there's a fair amount of money there, and some of those people are the children of some of those individuals who have means aren't going to our schools for lack of money. They are sending their children to even more expensive schools than ours. So access is an issue, not just for those without means, but also with means. Mission-focused teachers, whether or not somebody is Adventist, they need to understand the mission of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and its educational system. It's not just academic excellence. We have a much broader mission. And finally, we need to develop leadership. I apologize. It looks leader's hip, but it's leadership. I'm not sure why it did it that way. We have a great need in the system for principals and presidents and boards that function. Those are our priorities. Now, this is just a review, but I will bring it back to work shortly. These are the core features of Seventh-day Adventist education, regardless of the level, whether it's preschool, primary, secondary, tertiary, graduate school, medical school, dental school. The goals are the same, and I think that the goals are shared here with these schools as well. First of all, a redemptive purpose. That's why we're in education, to restore the image of God in students, to develop balanced, holistic development, to emphasize centrality of the Bible in all disciplines. In the past quinquennium, a little bit over, we have developed 3 new medical schools. For nearly 100 years, we had only one medical school. Actually, the first medical school was AMMC, the American Medical Missionary College. John Harvey Kellogg was the president, started at Battle Creek. It moved to Chicago. In 1913, it became part of the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Chicago, today University of Illinois. So our first medical school we lost. When John Harvey Kellogg moved out, we lost that. Loma Linda is medical school number 2. It's not till 1976 that we got another medical school, Monte Morelos. And now in the past quinquennium, we've gotten 3 more. River Plate was next, I think 1994. Now we have a medical school in Nigeria, one in Peru, one in the Philippines, and we are working to get a 7th one in Rwanda, which would serve the whole East Central Africa division. But even in medical education, the Bible is core. It is central. Whatever, dental school, we're working to develop a new dental school in Brazil. And it has to meet, of course, state regulations to be a dentist, but the Bible is central even there. To develop the ability to think and to do, to act, and this is where work comes in, to not merely reflect others' thoughts, to develop practical skills for life, and that's why manual labor is important, and prepare students for service in this life and the next for the whole period of existence. And you know this. This is from the book Education. Learning to work contributes to each of those, and this is too small for me and perhaps too small for you, but learning to work contributes to the development of discipline and self-control within the students, work ethic, industriousness and responsibility, accountability, time management, punctuality, how to balance study and work, problem solving and creativity, initiative and persistence. And these are things that you simply cannot learn in an English class. These are things that have to be learned within the context of doing work. To develop interpersonal skills with peers and supervisors. To develop communication skills. To develop financial self-sufficiency to understand the relationship between time and money. And just a point here, in Papua New Guinea, I think only about, it's 12% or so, the last I looked at the statistics, of the economy is financial. By far, the majority, the bulk of the economy in Papua New Guinea is bartering. So you exchange chicken for this or fruit for that. And so students, when they come to study at one of our schools, Pacific Adventist University or Sonoma College, do not understand the relationship between time and money. And they have, they call it work line. They have work line, which helps students understand the relationship of how their time relates to money. And this prepares them to function in a cash, cash economy. It's difficult for Papua New Guinea to get enough workers and to engage the youth in the workforce because they simply don't have the skills. They're not good workers. Work line, work habits develop good workers. And I overheard some of the conversation you had up there, which is one of the goals. Work also helps students learn how to be a blessing to others, and finally helps them understand and appreciate the meaning of a well-deserved Sabbath rest. As Seventh-day Adventists, we talk a lot about the Sabbath, but we should probably talk more about work, because the command is to work for 6 days and rest for one. We talk a lot about the resting, but we should also talk about what we should be doing on the other 6 days. I'd like to pause and introduce one example that might be familiar. I know Marius would be very familiar. This is one of his schools, Marian Her Academy. This is our secondary school in Darmstadt in Germany. We purchased it in 1924. It closed. It was closed by the secret police in 1933, and then it was closed from 1941 to 1948 when the German army had occupied it and used it as a hospital. When they purchased it from an American young lady by the name of Elizabeth Duncan. She and her sister Isadora, they were from New York. They had established a number of schools. Isadora established in Greece a temple of the arts, and Elizabeth purchased this property and established this as the so-called Elizabeth Duncan School. There you see a picture of Elizabeth with some of her students. This school, in all respects except for one, was very much like a Seventh-day Adventist school. It emphasized holistic, balanced development in students. It emphasized health and a healthy diet. It was on a beautiful estate at that time. And in all respects but one, it emphasized physical development. But the physical development was done through dance. Elizabeth Duncan was a ballroom dance instructor. And the parents were wealthy Germans who sent their daughters to this school to get a balanced development. And it was very, very successful. It was exclusive. But then World War I came. And so these parents who had means because of the war could not send their daughters primarily there anymore. And eventually we bought it, and Elizabeth Duncan moved to Paris, where Isadora had already started another school, and then eventually she moved to Austria. The ballroom in this school, Marian Her School here, where the girls learn dance and ballroom dancing today, is the chapel of our school there. It's remarkable to me that Ellen White could distinguish what elements of education were wholesome and good, and which elements to reject. In almost all respects, it was the same, except Ellen White, while she promoted physical development, she did not promote dance. And this was built around dance. And in the end, it failed. The same in the area of health. There were many health reformers. Ellen White was not the only one. Perhaps you know Sylvester Graham, or the Graham cracker. That still exists today, was whole wheat, a whole wheat cracker. So some things she knew to keep, and other things, like when she went to the Danville Sanitarium, she rejected. There at the Danville Sanitarium, James White became ill. He was there. But she rejected certain elements she saw there, such as the recreation, the playing of cards, and lounging out. She wanted James to get out and do work, and she even told the neighbors at one point, don't help him with the field. She wanted him to get out there and have hard physical work. So she could distinguish during the trends of her day which things were of God and which were not, because the Lord revealed these things to her. And this school is still functioning today. After the war, the church, again, got it. One of the trends today in many of our schools is to develop a gymnasium. And at one of our schools right now is investing a lot of money to do that. And one of the arguments that I have heard put forward is if we don't have a gymnasium that the others do, students will go elsewhere. It's cold. Where the school is, and they're convinced about the need to have a gymnasium in order to retain students. Well, Ellen White covered this ground too, and I'll just read one quote there. She says, "Those who combine useful labor with study have no need of gymnastic exercises, and work performed in the open air is tenfold more beneficial to health than indoor labor. Nothing short of nature's invigorating air and sunshine will fully meet the demands of the system. The tiller of the soil finds in his labor all the movements that were ever practiced in the gymnasium. His movement room is the open fields." And she goes on here. I just happened to be visiting one school that has a huge physical education program, and I saw students there doing some work. And I just happened to have another picture of somebody else who's doing some gardening and truly doing the same type of motion and even more, with the long-term result of having something to show for his effort. I personally am not in support of this move of investing a lot of money into gymnasiums and then neglecting the things that Ellen White, through counsel, has given us. Importance of practical labor for optimal growth and development. More counsel from Ellen White. If the youth can have but a one-sided education, which is of the greater consequence, a knowledge of the sciences with all the disadvantages to health and life, or a knowledge of labor for practical life, we unhesitatingly answer the latter. If one must be neglected, let it be the study of books. The two should go together. Now, some of you know this gentleman. I don't know if the Lynn, just blanking on that, Lynn Hogue. Perhaps you don't. Well, he has done some workshops on agriculture, and here is an example of two trees that he planted, one using methods that he has studied and developed. The first tree is done with the method that he, in reading Ellen White and other books, has developed. And the second one, they were planted at the same time. It's hard to see on here, but this is the one tree that planted at the same time using these, let's say, good principles of agricultural development. And here are two planted at the same time, just using normal methods. And they've had the same amount of water. It's just the difference in how he prepared the soil. But it's the same with the development of young people. We can put them in a school, and if you use the right methods that are revealed to us through Scripture and the writings of Ellen White, with the same passage of time, we can get more balanced, healthier development than if we just go the way of the world. And you all know this, Madison College was to be an example of balanced education. Avondale College also was to be an example. One time she wrote back from Corumbong, from Australia to Battle Creek. She said, "No winds of Battle Creek blowing here," referring to Battle Creek College, because there was a continual struggle about where to place it. She said, put it in the countryside, and they put it on a city block. And Avondale was put way out in the countryside, and so was Madison. But she writes, "Much acceptable work has been done in Madison. The Lord says to you, go forward. The school is to be an example of how Bible study, general education, physical education, and sanitarium work may be combined in many smaller schools that shall be established in simplicity in many places in the southern states. And I know that many of you count yourself to be the grandchildren of Madison College, following from that, although Madison itself does not exist. And I've said that I hope somebody would do a doctoral dissertation on what happened to its demise so that we can learn those lessons and ensure the vitality of our organizations into the future. But she did say that there should be many smaller ones, and so I congratulate all of you who are carrying out that vision. She writes, "The work that the laborers have accomplished at Madison has done more to give a correct knowledge of what an all-round education," and I noticed Charles used those words yesterday, an all-round. We don't say that anymore in today's language. We would probably say all-around, but all-round. "An all-round education means that at any other school that has been established by Seventh-day Adventists in America, the Lord has given these teachers in the South an education that is of highest value, and it is a training that God would be pleased to have all our youth receive. A balanced development." And here you see a picture from, I won't say. Anybody know where this is from? One of our schools. I'll let you study that a little bit longer while I read. She writes, "A return to simple methods will be appreciated by the children and youth. Work in the garden and field will be an agreeable change from the wearisome routine of abstract lessons." This is New Bold College at Sylvia's Garden there on the compound. And today it's on the British Heritage list as a garden to be protected. But it is truly beautiful and a privilege to be able to do there. When I was a student, we would have these work days and everybody, students and teachers, would get out and do the raking. And at that time, they still had a farm. We would all get out there and for a full day, bring in the potatoes. That was a lot of fun, students and teachers alike. But that no longer is there. But they still maintain the gardens, and truly our campuses should be beautiful places. She writes, "Gardening and nature, no line of manual training is of more value than agriculture. Let the teacher call attention to what the Bible says about agriculture. In the study of agriculture, let pupils be given not only theory, but practice." And this is what is wonderful about work programs, the opportunity to apply what is learned and to see the results. "Aesthetic and social development promoted." This is Sonoma Adventist College. Anybody been there? This is on the remote island of New Britain in the Pacific Ocean, politically belonging to Papua New Guinea. And she writes, "In planning for the culture of plants, let the teacher seek to awaken an interest in beautifying the school grounds and the schoolroom. A double benefit will result. That which the pupils seek to beautify, they will be unwilling to have marred or defaced. A refined taste, a love of order, and a habit of caretaking will be encouraged, and the spirit of fellowship and cooperation developed will provide to the pupils a lifelong blessing." Sonoma College has about 400 students. They're coming from the remote islands of the Pacific. If you look at a map of the Pacific, they're tiny little spots of islands. Students come from these remote islands. It's expensive in the Pacific to fly from these places to Sonoma. So when they get there, they stay there all 4 years. Some are coming from the highlands of Papua New Guinea, from villages where they're living in huts right over the dirt with chickens and pigs beneath it. Houses are unpainted. And here it is called Workline. When we do accreditation visits, we always ask students, "What do you like best about this college?" At this school, a group of boys said what they liked the best about Sonoma College was Workline. So we asked them, "Why do you like Workline?" They said, "Because we learn how to do things. We learn how to paint. We learn how to fix electrical things. We do things that we never got to do at home." Many of these students are quite poor. When I was there, two young men had enough money to get there and spend one semester, but then their money ran out. So they were working full-time in the gardens. And this campus is truly lovely. One of the faculty members, a Filipino man, directs the work line for the grounds, and he teaches them how to plant rice by hand, because he said when they go back to their villages, they're not going to have machines, so he wants them to learn how to do it. They'll do it there. And he told me about another student who went to the highlands to do his student teaching. He got to that remote village, and the very first thing he did was instruct all his little students to start cleaning up the schoolyard and to start planting, making some plantings. And their schoolyard looked so nice. So this was a young man, but he knew what to do when he got to that village. And it was beautiful, like this campus. That's what work draws students in, to help develop an appreciation for beauty and how to, when they leave those places, to replicate that in their places of life and service. Agriculture to improve school meals. And she writes here, study in agricultural lines should be the A, B, and C of the education given in our schools. This is the very first work that should be entered upon. Our schools should not depend upon imported produce for grain and vegetables and the fruit so essential to health. Pacific Adventist University near Port Moresby is a good example of this. They have a large property and a very big campus farm in which they grow everything, beans and squashes and lettuce and tomatoes, and also some cash crops like vanilla orchids, which they're able to harvest and sell. And the best of the products, they have made a contract with the supermarkets in Port Moresby, which is a capital city of Papua New Guinea. They sell the best produce to the supermarkets by contract, and the not-so-beautiful ones they use in the cafeteria. But I can tell you, they still look great. They're just wonderful, fresh-picked things. And once a week, was it twice a week, they have a farmer's market where people come to their campus to buy things as well. And students learn how to grow things. The fruit of work to bless others. So she writes, so also a new interest may be given to the work of the garden, and pupils are encouraged to remember those shut in. So already they have opportunity for learning how to be a blessing. One of the things about gardening is when things get ripe, it gets ripe in big quantities all at once. And it causes you to think of who you can give these zucchinis to and other things that are just in excess. Using God's second book to teach. Again, continue with Ellen White. She writes, of the almost innumerable lessons taught in the varied processes of growth, some of the most precious are conveyed in the Savior's parable of the growing seed. As parents and teachers try to teach these lessons, the work should be made practical. Let the children themselves prepare the soil and sow the seed. And we've heard some of those stories yesterday and even this morning. The great teacher brought his hearers in contact with nature, that they might listen to the voice which speaks in all created things. And as their hearts become tender and their minds receptive, he helped them to interpret the spiritual teaching of the scenes upon which their eyes rested. So we should teach. That's a teaching method for us, bringing young people in contact with nature, allowing it to be quiet enough so they can hear the Lord speak. There is a nurse, a faculty member at Loma Linda University School of Medicine, Dr. Bernadine Irwin, who works with troubled young teens. And one of the things she does is take these troubled inner-city teens on retreats, either to the mountains or to Catalina Island. And so many of these troubled young teens have never been outside of the city before. Just being out there in the mountains speaks to them. She's written a lovely book on that called Jessica's Story, just a short-term intervention and how that allows students to hear God's voice, young people. Direct contact with nature and God. She writes, Ellen White, there is a simplicity and purity in these lessons directly from nature that makes them of the highest value. The children and youth, all classes of students, need the lessons to be derived from this source. In itself, the beauty of nature leads the soul away from sin and worldly attractions and toward purity, peace, and God. For this reason, the cultivation of the soil is good work for children and youth. It brings them into direct contact with nature and nature's God. Does anybody recognize this campus? I talked with somebody at lunch who said he studied here. This is Adventist International Institute of Advanced Studies in the Philippines. It was after a AAA accreditation visit. We talked with students, and one of the students, I don't remember if he came from Pakistan or Bangladesh or India, he came with his young family, two little boys, and he said when they got to this campus, the boys ran across these green lawns, and they have little play areas. This is graduate only, master's degrees and doctoral degrees, and it's especially caters to young families because these are graduate students and they normally have children. So they're little swing sets and seesaws and other places for the children to play. So the boys ran across the lawn to this little play area and they played a bit, they swang on the swings, and then they came back, and then he said the little one looked up at him and he said, "Daddy, are we in heaven?" That's what our campuses should be like. And if we bring young people in contact with nature, God is able to speak. Manual training and practical duties. When the child is old enough to be sent to school, Ellen White writes, the teacher should cooperate with the parents, and manual training should be continued as part of his school duties. Now, that's a key thought there, cooperate with the parents, because in many instances, the parents are not very cooperative. And at the end of this, I am going to call for some discussion on how we can address some of the obstacles. One of the obstacles are parents who do not understand why, when they're ready to pay good money, why their child is having to do some work. Many think that these things, the practical duties of life, are no part of the schoolwork, but this is a mistake. The lessons necessary to fit one for practical usefulness should be taught to every child in the home and to every student in the schools. Now, many of us are getting students who have not learned these practical duties in the home. And so we've got a handicap to start with. And then when these programs are implemented, the parents themselves are part of the resistance. Development of habits of industry. Ellen White writes that manual training is deserving of far more attention than it has received. Multitudes of our boys would thus be kept from the street corner and the groggery, and the youth themselves trained to habits of industry and skilled in lines of usefulness and productive labor, who can estimate their value to society and to the nation? Papua New Guinea is one of those places where the town of Port Moresby is really quite frightening. I have never gone sightseeing in Port Moresby just because of safety. I go to the campus, and I'm glad when I get back. I'm relieved when there is not a barricade across the road with somebody trying to stop us and rob us. There are entirely too many young people, especially young men, who've gotten an education, and I'm not talking about Adventist education, in the public system, who now have been detached from their traditional way of life. They're no longer living in the village. They don't have the work skills to be attractive to employers. They chew a lot of betel nut, which is really quite disgusting. You see a lot of these red splats on the road. The betel nut gets kind of frothy, and then to me it looks like bubbly blood when they spit it out. In fact, the plane that I took there, the last plane said, do not spit betel nut on the ground of the plane. You have to wear slippers, and you can't spit betel nut on the plane floor. But they chew betel nut, which is a mild stimulant, have nothing to do, have a lot of the hormones running of young manhood, are not in their village where social constraints can moderate their behavior, and so they are just loitering and waiting for some tourist to go by whose purse they can snatch, and there's a high incidence of rape there as well. they simply have been unfitted for life in modern society. So while they can read, they can do the numbers, they don't have the work habits to enable them to get viable employment. And so they're just there in limbo and angry, seething anger. And it's a disservice. Education has been a disservice to them compared to the experience that students get at Sonoma Adventist College or at Pacific Adventist University, where through the work-study program, not what happens in the classroom, but through what happens in work-study, they develop the types of skills that make them attractive to employers. But the key to any work-study program is supervisors. And she writes about that. Manual training is deserving of far more attention than it has received. Schools should be established that, in addition to the highest mental and moral culture, shall provide the best possible facilities for physical development and industrial training. Instruction should be given in agriculture, manufacturing, covering as many as possible of the most useful trades. Also in household economy, healthful cookery, sewing, hygienic dressmaking, the treatment of the sick, and kindred lines. Gardens, workshops, and treatment rooms should be provided, and the work in every line should be under the direction of skilled instructors. In my work and in my assessment of schools around the world, this is what I see as the greatest need: supervisors of work-study programs. There is not a lack of need of human hurt in this world. There's not enough food, there's not enough of health care, but we just don't have enough people who are able to supervise students in work-study programs. And teachers are already full-time busy doing just what they need. And I think it's a lack of vision on the part of administration that they don't see the need to employ people as part of payroll to oversee the work education. At Sonoma College, I told you about the Filipino man. He is employed full-time. He teaches, and he has time. But some of the teachers there are just resentful of any additional demands being made on them because they've got families to care for. They have the Friday evening meetings. They have Sabbath evenings. They're involved with Pathfinders, and it's just not fair to ask them to do anything more. The administration needs to see the need for it and employ people to oversee these programs. Theory and practice in the study of agriculture: let pupils be given not only the theory, but practice, while they learn what science can teach in regard to nature and the preparation of the soil, the value of different crops, and the best methods of production. Let them put their knowledge to use. Let teachers share the work with the students and show what results can be achieved through skillful, intelligent effort. And on this point, if teachers are to be involved in overseeing work study, it should be part of their teaching load. That it needs to be calculated in with what they're expected to do, because they do have other responsibilities as well. And that's where it comes down to vision of the administration. When we do an evaluation, we look at the finances too, and I ask, let me see your budget line for work study programs. And all too many places have just a pittance in there, which tells me they don't have a viable program. If they're not budgeting for it, and if there aren't assigned people, it simply cannot be successful. It's just going to be sporadic on the goodwill of an individual person. She saw agriculture as contributing to self-support. These are avocados at Ethiopia Adventist College in Shoshamane, a remote place south of Addis Ababa. They don't have many trees, but they have some, and this is a place where you just can't go across the street to the shop. You have to learn to be self-sufficient there. She writes, students should be given a practical education in agriculture. This would be inestimable value to many in their future work. The training to be obtained in felling trees. I'm going to need to move over here. I apologize. This is so tiny. In felling trees and in tilling the soil, as well as in literary lines, is the education that our youth should seek to obtain. Agriculture will open resources for self-support. Other lines of work adapted to different students may also be carried on, but the cultivation of the land will bring a special blessing to the workers. We should so train the youth that they will love to engage in the cultivation of the soil. There at Shoshamane, they have large fields, as many of our properties do, and they grow spelt there. But I didn't see that they were systematically involving students in the work. And that's because students are generally terrible workers. They're unreliable. They don't know what to do. If they have a test, they make excuses for why they're not going to be there, and it gets frustrating for the farm manager who is depending on students to be able to do this. And that's why the staff need to understand the philosophy and know that students come in as terrible workers. They need to learn how to work. That's why they're there. And they just have to do it over and over and over again. As each new group of students come in, it will be the same group of set of frustrations, because they don't know how to do this yet. So you need somebody who has the vision and the patience to do it over and over again. Directors of Work and Manual Labor, and Ellen White writes, a much larger number of young people need to have the advantages of our schools. They need the manual training course, which will teach them how to live an active, energetic life. Under wise, judicious, God-fearing directors, the students are to be taught different kinds of labor. Each branch of the work is to be conducted in the most thorough, systematic way that long experience and wisdom can enable us to plan and execute. And some exemplars here are Montemorelos University in Mexico, and Dr. Raquel Kornichuk, the vice president of academics there, has a vision for how the work program fits in the overall program of education. It's structured, it's grounded in a philosophy of service, and it's sufficiently overseen. Another good example is Mountain View College in the Philippines. In the Philippines, there are a number of schools that have students who come from very poor places. There are many islands of the Philippines. They come from remote islands, again, living in nipa huts that have bamboo slats and chickens and pigs underneath. And when they come to school, they don't have the money or the skills to be productive in the work-study program. By the way, Mountain View has a great worm farm, too. It's tropical places. There's a lot of organic material, and they use these worms to compost the organic material, and then use the compost to fertilize the grounds. So it's a wonder, and they even sell the worms as well. Dominican Adventist University also uses worms for composting. And they use the kitchen waste as well as material from the grounds to compost, and then use that compost in the grounds. But it takes effort. I just was speaking to Hope Aparecho, the new academic vice president, who has revitalized the work-study program at Mountain View, and she put a full-time director in that program who supports the philosophy of service and then oversees, and all students are expected to do 4 hours free per week, and then they can do additional work. Some students there are on the 8-year program or the 10-year program, meaning it takes them 10 years to get a bachelor's degree, and that's because they cannot study full-time. They don't have the money. But what a blessing that in 10 years' time they're able to get an education. And not only that, not just a degree, the skills of self-sufficiency and a variety of work areas. And I see Filipinos around the world, in Africa and some of the most challenging places, because they become very industrious. They learn how to do a variety of things. They have the initiative and the persistence. At the time, it seems like a terrible setback that you can't finish in 4 years. But what you learn in those 10 years equips them for truly useful service in some of the most challenging parts of the world. Kaizen, or the Japanese word for continuous quality improvement. Work, doing things, and I heard it here in your discussion, doing things over and over again. There's value in doing that. I used to teach at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. I was the assistant dean there. And I was talking to the head of the surgery clerkship. He was a surgeon, and he said, I can always tell which medical student is going to go into surgery and the one who is going to go in some other discipline. He said, the student that comes and we're doing a hernia repair and they say, oh no, not another hernia repair. He said, I know that student is not going to become a surgeon. He said, the student that's going to become a surgeon will say, all right, now this time I'm going to get the tension on the stitches just right. And they do it very carefully. I was asked to write a recommendation for one of the medical students once, and she wanted to go into surgery. And so I asked her, what are your hobbies? She said, I love doing cross-stitch. I go to the craft store, and I look at all the cross-stitch patterns, and then I'll take a new one. And I ask, don't you get bored doing it? Don't you feel like, oh, no, another cross-stitch project? She goes, oh, no. So I just love doing it just right. And I'm sure she made a great surgeon who can take pleasure in getting the stitch just right. And that's the kind of person I want doing my surgery as well. So doing things over and over again is in itself a lesson. And Ellen White writes, manual training should develop habits of accuracy and thoroughness. Pupils should learn fact and system. They should learn to economize time and to make every move count. They should be inspired with ambition constantly to improve. Let it be their aim to make their work as nearly perfect as human brains and hands can make it. Too many students feel bored, but they are missing the opportunity to learn the lesson inherent in a task and doing it more efficiently, coming up with a new creative way to do things. Oh, an exemplar here is Union College. Union College, in my view, has one of the best work programs of any of our accredited colleges in North America. And that is because students apply for a job at Union College. They're going to work in the student accounts office. They interview just as if they were going for a job. They have to dress properly. They're interviewed by the staff. They get periodic evaluations just as if they were a regular employee. They get that feedback. They have opportunity to improve. And by the end of the 4 years, those students appear professional. They are able to conduct themselves and enter the working world. And it's because of the way the staff at Union College treat those students. When we did the interview with the staff and the faculty, that's the only college where I heard the staff say things like this. And staff, I mean the director of the accounting office or the person working in records or the one working in the maintenance area. They say, our students, and fill in the blank, even though they're not in the classroom, they see that they have a role in educating our students. And I credit Dr. Dave Smith with that. He built a real spirit of esprit de corps among the faculty. So it's not faculty over here doing the esoteric things and the staff doing menial supervisory things, but they all saw themselves as part of the team educating our students. There at Union College, pacing myself here, there at Union College, they have the Ortner Center, which is the guest services. And when you go to the Ortner Center, as I do, if I can stay on campus, I do, rather than staying in a hotel, I'm greeted by a student, I'm checked in by a student, I'm given my room card key, I'm told when breakfast is and all of the various things. Then the students clean the rooms, and then when I leave, the students check me out. Students get that experience right there in customer service, so they're not employing outsiders or regular staff people. As an administrator, I understand why it's so tempting to hire staff. And that's because students are unreliable. They're not there all the time. And so you've got to get a job done. But Russell. Sharon Russell, the wife of Malcolm Russell, is the one that oversees the Ortner Center. She too had a vision for how this fits in with the students' overall education. Christ modeled work ethic. And ultimately, it's Christ himself. He had 33 years, and he chose to do 30 of those doing ordinary kinds of things. He was going to save the whole world, the universe, but yet he lived what seemed to be a very ordinary life. In his earthly life, Christ was an example to all the human family. He learned the carpenter's trade and worked with his own hands in the little shop at Nazareth. And as he worked in childhood and youth, mind and body were developed. In the children and in youth, an ambition should be awakened to take their exercise in doing something that will be beneficial to themselves and helpful to others. He, Christ, was not willing to be defective even in the handling of tools. He was perfect as a workman, as he was perfect in character. Work is not something that is beneath us as human beings. Some models that I've already mentioned of having very good work-study programs, Mountain View College, also Nagaview in the Philippines, in Mindanao, Nagaview College in Luzon in the Philippines. This is another place where students might take 8 years, 10 years to finish their education because they're working. Central Philippine Adventist College. In this case, the unions have built little houses so that so-called working students can live in them, work, and they take as long as they take because they're working. They also cook their own food, which is not ideal because they just eat a lot of rice, and that's about it. They're working students. I do think that it's important that even working students eat in the cafeteria as much as possible, because students left to their own devices will eat peanut butter and bread and rice and rice and rice, and it's important for them to get an adequate nutrition. They have to learn that too. Zawoksky Adventist University, this is in Russia. They have greenhouses. This is in a cold place in Russia, but very good greenhouses, and in the summertime an open farm. Avondale College and both Friedensau University, Avondale and Australia and Friedensau, have a nursing home nearby which provides students with opportunities for work. And I know one of your schools, was it Fletcher or which one? Has a nursing home, which is, it's wonderful, giving them opportunity to learn work skills, to be a blessing, to bring joy to these nursing home residents, and also gain a perspective they could not gain in any other way. Universidad Peruana Union, it has a bakery, and it also has a print shop, a very active print shop, both of which the bakery provides bread in a large area in Peru, and the print shop does printing services also outside for the whole union as well as outside. Learning the duties of practical life. Various industries should be carried on in our schools. The industrial instruction given should include the keeping of accounts, carpentry, and all that is comprehended in farming. Preparation should be made for the teaching of blacksmithing. Well, I don't know what that would be today. Maybe it might be computer repair. So, Charles, thank you, and Phil, what you did. We might change that to computer repair rather than blacksmithing today. Painting, shoemaking, and for cooking, baking, washing, mending, typewriting, and printing. Every power at our command is to be brought into this training work that students may go forth well-equipped for the duties of practical life. For the lady students, there are many employments which should be provided that may have a comprehensive and practical education. They should be taught dressmaking, gardening. Flowers should be cultivated. I love that. It's not just the practical things, but the aesthetic component. Strawberries planted. Thus, while being educated in useful labor, they will have healthful outdoor exercise. Ellen White was so practical, so wise, and this is not outdated counsel. Women today, it's just the fact that women still have primary responsibility for the home, for childcare. They need to learn these even in our modern society, even if they have a career of their own. Now, let's talk about a little bit about finances, the cost of running these programs, and they do cost money. There's no way around it. And Ellen White faced that obstacle too. The objection, she writes, most often urged against industrial training in the schools is the large outlay involved. But the object to be gained is worthy of the cost. No other work committed to us is as important as the training of the youth, and every outlay demanded for its right accomplishment is means well spent. When we do accreditation visits, as I mentioned, we look at the finances. And with your own accreditation work, I would recommend that you look at the finances of the schools. Are they really allocating the needed resources for a successful work-study program? We cannot expect it to succeed if the budget does not allocate for the student supervision, first of all, and then for whatever costs are associated with that line of work. And she writes, even from the viewpoint of financial results, the outlay required for manual training would prove the truest economy. The expenditure for gardens, workshops, and baths would be more than met by the savings on hospitals and reformatories. And the youth themselves, trained to habits of industry and skilled in lines of useful and productive labor, who can estimate their value to society and to the nation? You cannot see this, but I will provide a copy of this to your on the memory stick. But this is developed by Lorraine Siebold. It was used at Weimar Academy. And it is a rubric that is used by those supervising students in work-study programs to assess their competency, the degree to which, see if we can see a few of these words. So the very first one there is dress. And it goes from the highest level of competency to the lowest level of competency, communication skills, perseverance, persistence, and so on. So this will be a useful tool, and perhaps many of you already have something like this. But just like in the classroom, if you don't grade it, if you don't assess it, it communicates to the student it's not important. They need to be clear about what the skill is that you're seeking to develop, as they do at Union College, and then given that feedback, and this is tagged to specific competencies and descriptors. The next one is a graphic that was developed by Dr. Randy Siebold when he was at Weimar College, and it describes the work education program at Weimar. And this is the agricultural class, and he writes that this is a lab class which meets on the farm. It was taught by somebody named Rocco. And it says, he will work as able with college and academy biology teachers. The class may be repeated or advanced, may also have an improved exercise plan or recreational activity. Then there was a vocational apprenticeship training program. He identified volunteer teachers, the class sizes, Sunday class times, the apprenticeship being long-term or full-time, internships connected to a course of study, and campus jobs. There were two types of work programs they had there, the non-paid ones and the paid campus jobs. The non-paid ones included agriculture and an outdoor exercise class, an approved outdoor exercise plan, and recreational activities were part of that. There were vocational apprenticeship and training classes, and then internships that possibly could be paid related to a discipline. And this you'll have on the memory stick. There are also some external resources. Perhaps you're already aware of them. The Work Colleges Consortium, and this is it's a consortium of schools that have active work-study programs. Some of them are faith-based and others are not. But the Work-Study Consortium, they share two fundamental beliefs. First, that a college experience should educate the whole person. Same thing we say. Second, earning a college degree shouldn't require a lifetime of debt. And I think we would also agree on that. It horrifies me when I see the amount of debt the students have coming out of Loma Linda University. Through an innovative approach to work learning service, all work college students offset college costs by participating in a mandatory work program performing service in their communities. Most work positions are limited to 8 to 15 hours per week, designed to enhance a student's academic studies. The work-learning service approach teaches students the critical balance of study, service to others, and managed work expectations. And they have a website, workcolleges.org. I'll read one more slide from the Work College's consortium. According to alumni, 4 years of purposeful work has a lifetime of payoff. Graduates of work colleges enter their careers prepared with real-world skills and owing reduced or no debt. Research confirms that a work-learning service approach to higher education builds character, work ethic, leadership, and competence in critical thinking and time management skills. These attributes are directly transferable to the workplace and are among the characteristics employers say that they most need. If you go to the website, you'll see more resources related to work study. For us, though, and for Ellen White, work was related to an even longer-term goal than being able to take up a job. And that was preparing young people for foreign service or for outreach opportunity. And Ellen White writes here, the usefulness learned on the school farm is the very education that is most essential to those who go out as missionaries to many foreign fields. If this training is given with the glory of God in view, great results will be seen. No work will be more effectual than that done by those who have obtained an education in practical life to go forth to mission fields with a message of truth, prepared to instruct as they have been instructed. The knowledge they have obtained in the tilling of the soil and other lines of manual work and which they carry with them to the fields of labor will make them a blessing even in heathen lands. I was in Bolivia Adventist University, and I met Peter Schmidt, who is a good example of that. He learned printing skills. He took those skills with him to Bolivia. He now has a very active printing press on the campus. They employ some students, not many, but they do employ some. And he has been a tremendous blessing to the work of the church in Bolivia, which is a fairly, I wouldn't say repressive government, but it's a challenging environment in which to work. A very practical skill of printing. He's Swiss, and he's been able to bring in fact, his relatives even contributed to buying a printing press. He prints all the Sabbath school lessons for the country. He even developed a small little pocket-sized Sabbath school lesson for the students that they can easily carry, the books and so on, but someone who's working in a challenging place with very practical skills. I'd like to spend the remaining time and then get some comment from you on obstacles. Obstacles to successful programs, external legal regulations, and I'm sorry I missed the presentation yesterday as they switched the order around, on legal regulations, parental expectations. I mentioned the Elizabeth Duncan School, but we have examples even among our own midst. I hear this complaint at our schools that parents are sending their children or their young adult children to university, and they don't want them out on the farm. They want them learning skills for white-collar jobs. The student expectations themselves and student ignorance about the benefits of work study, and I've heard these complaints at places like Selusi University in Zimbabwe, which was an economic train wreck. The country for years has really, really suffered, and even their students did not understand the benefit of work study. They had a huge farm, they had a reservoir, they had a large lake, and they had pretty much an idle farm in the midst of this economic desert. For the lack of having the vision of developing the farms. At one time, they had vineyards, they had guavas, they still had the orange trees, but they had just let them go, and they were no longer cultivated. Then they brought a farm manager from the U.S. That was good. But the farm manager got distracted and married a local girl, and the farm just didn't do very much. And so the last time I was there, the farm still was just idle with these two big water sources and this huge property and the students themselves who were resisting it in the face of truly, truly difficult economic situation. The students only had two meals a day. There just wasn't food out there. And they could have grown anything there, and they had the water, the land, but there it was lack of vision and a lack of management. Babcock University, about 8,000 students there in Nigeria, and there, one of the good things is they beautified the campus. The past president, his wife had a PhD in agriculture, and so she had really invested a lot of energy in developing a nursery, and it's a beautiful campus. But only a limited number of students of the 8,000 were involved in a work-study program. And the students themselves there and at University of Eastern Africa, Baraton, had very different ideas about what they should do in a university, and that did not include work. In fact, the student government there at one of those two universities, I won't name which one, when they were elected, they collected fees from all the students. They used it to get an SUV and a driver for the president of the student government so that he could be driven from one place to another. And that's how the world leads. That is how too many leaders in Africa and other places, when they get the power and they get the resources, they don't use it to benefit others. They use it to benefit themselves. The election, I was there at one time, another campus during elections, and the campaigning there was the campaigning you would expect to hear in a public setting, where the students were promising this and promise that. You put me in office and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, which primarily was adversarial to the administration, which again, that's what we see in the world, and that's not the type of leadership that we want to cultivate. And this is where a good, robust work-study program will help students develop the types of attitudes of service and leadership that we want from Adventist education. And when you get too big, 5, 6, 7, 8,000, it's difficult to oversee a large work-study program without really robust structures. Then there are internal obstacles, the need to manage workers, to teach students how to work. This is the challenge I saw there at Solusi. They had put all their hopes in this one American farm manager who got distracted, and then it just didn't go farther. And I think the administration itself did not use resources closer at home that it could have, and they underestimated the benefit that could be made by focusing energy on developing the work program. The cost of management, it will cost money to manage these programs well, and misunderstanding, spirit of criticism, a lack of collaboration with the organized work of the church. I see this as an obstacle. The schools and the ESAE group, you're doing far more with work study than in many of our organized schools. But we need to have more interaction, more collaboration. And I think there's misunderstanding and criticism on both sides. I often tell our organized schools that these schools are more Adventist than the Adventist schools that we accredit. But we need to have a spirit of collaboration between both those that are working in the organized part of the church and those that are working in self-supporting institutions. We need, as I said, more collaboration between our schools. An example of where it has been difficult, and Dr. Cavaness, maybe you remember, that at the time it was called the Parent School, now it's University of Gitwe. It grew out of the Gitwe Adventist School with some parents who were dissatisfied primarily with the cost of Adventist education. They started their own, and it's huge now, and they even have a medical school. But they compete with the organized institution with tuition rates. And for that can be an area of competition, because a self-supporting school in some ways has less overhead. Because, I don't know all the reasons why, but one might be inadequately funding a retirement plan. And I do think that needs to be addressed in funding, so that at the end of a long career, somebody has some buffer. But they are competing, and there's been, I think, stealing of workers one way and the other. So when schools are in close proximity, we need to even have more collaboration and more communication so that we don't develop a spirit of competition, but spirit of collaboration. There are many privately owned schools that are operated by Adventist lay people. Some of these, an example is in Bangkok in Thailand, or some that are doing a great work like Helen Hall. She turns 80 years old this year. She started a school on the border of Myanmar and Thailand for these displaced people, doing a wonderful work with about 1,000 students there, having to independently raise funds. India and Africa has many private schools that is owned by Seventh-day Adventist lay people, but the church, the organized work, and these self-supporting or private businesses, I think we really have to make concerted effort to foster collaboration and shared mission. Then there are, I think, just general issues that inhibit collaboration. One of them is use of the SDA brand. Legally, in order to use Seventh-day Adventist in the title or name of a school, it has to be owned and operated by the church, not a private business or a private independent 501c3 in this country. And that can create hard feelings and misunderstanding. Developing corporate know-how across the system. I think many of our organized schools can learn from what you all are doing in your schools, but we need a forum for developing and sharing that corporate know-how, how to manage these programs successfully. And I think one forum could be the Journal of Adventist Education. And I invite you to consider writing for the Journal of Adventist Education to share what you have learned with Adventist education broadly. That's in four languages, English, Spanish, Portuguese, and French. I think another obstacle to successful work-study programs in our independent schools or our self-supporting schools is a development of cult of personality. And that can happen in our own schools or the inability to pass the vision to successors. And I've been asking some questions. Why did Madison fail? Sutherland had a great vision. How did that falter? How did that not get passed on? And that's a challenge. One of your schools can develop a lot of capacity. There's a strong leader, and that strong leader goes someplace else. How do you pass that vision on? How do you ensure that it continues strong into the future? And board governance is another thing. Boards ultimately are responsible for passing on vision and ensuring vitality of the mission into the future. Here's a picture that I saw when I was driving from Gitwe. It was just out in the middle of nowhere in Rwanda. And if you can read Kenya, Rwanda, did you learn Kenya, Rwanda while you were there? Learned a little bit of Kenya, Rwanda. Well, I don't understand Kenya, Rwanda either completely, but I could understand this part here, and it says Pastor Teddy Wilson, not exactly. And I was told it says something essentially that I'm a follower of Pastor Teddy Wilson. So this cult, personality of cult can happen in any place. It can happen in following Ellen White or E.A. Sutherland or today Teddy Wilson. I leave us with this from Paul. And Paul writes to the Corinthians, I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree with one another in what you say, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly united in mind and thought. My brothers and sisters, some from Chloe's household have informed me that there are quarrels among you. What I mean is this. One of you says, I follow Paul, another, I follow Paulus, another, I follow Cephas, still another, I follow Christ. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. And I think that's where we need to keep our eye, whether we're working in the organized work of education, whether you're working in an independent school, whether you are a private business person who have your own business, like a shoe shop, or in this case it would be a school. One of the schools here is private, and it says right in its mission statement, this school follows the philosophy of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It's one University Gateway. If you go to their website, you'll see right in their first paragraph of what they are. It's owned primarily by one family. It's a family business, but they put right up there, we follow the philosophy of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Whatever side of the road we're on, let us keep in view our mission as educators to engage in that redemptive process, to keep our eyes on Christ, the purpose for which we're doing, and to find unity and collaboration in our system overall. Thank you. Is there time for a question or two or a comment or two? My question is, how could we expand the corporate know-how that has been developed in ISAE schools over the last 100 years, particularly in the area of work program? This is an area that you are still strong in. We do have pockets of it, as I pointed out, among some of the higher education institutions around the world. But overall, we've pretty much let those, I wouldn't say die, but just be vestigial elements, not much different from any other school system. Yes, sir.
Well, sort of to answer the question you asked there, you had asked an earlier question as well about the resistance that you receive from parents and so forth. In our previous panel, it was discussed that there needs to be cooperation between the family and the church and the schools, and that's been a theme, that's kind of been a running theme. Most people don't know the quotes that you posted here, right? These are in the councils that are to our church, and most people don't know them. So parents that don't know those are more likely to be resistant of them than parents that are aware of them. And so it's incumbent upon the churches, because how will they know without a preacher? It's incumbent upon the churches to highlight these councils that we have. Then people will be able to cooperate with them, then the work would be a lot easier. And that even goes for this too. We need to share those councils because a lot of the areas where we see failures, the things you pointed out in your presentation, a lot of it is variance with the council. If everybody's on the same page, then you're more likely to see success in that work than if everybody's just trying to figure out what the right thing is.
Thank you very much. Absolutely. It's incumbent upon us as educators to communicate to parents. And it is a challenge when those parents are not Adventists. So we need to find creative ways of communicating what makes Adventist education unique in our overall purpose. And what I say is it's not primarily financial. It's great if students can help defray some of their costs, but it's the qualities of character that it develops that I see is of the greatest benefit. Yes, Charles.
So Dr. Beardsley's asked a really great question, and I would just respond from the standpoint of ISAE and say we would like to open the dialogue on how we can be more effectively used to assist the schools in reconnecting with this model. And we would be, this group here has some expertise, but we're ready to learn as well. And I think that I think we need some programs that probably investigate that connection. When I say that, an opportunity to talk with maybe some schools that are interested in learning more about that model in a place where we could all feel free to. In a sense, sometimes we're afraid to talk about the challenges. And there are challenges everywhere. I know that our schools have challenges in terms of, we're trying and we're experimenting and we try one thing and it doesn't work and we try something else. But I think the more we can share it together, the greater will be the blessing to all. And this is ISAE's first attempt at something like this, but we would invite a joint attempt where we would work together to bring schools and teachers together who have an interest in pursuing how can we do better at the practical side of education as well. But I really seriously would like to hear from anyone here what ideas they would have on how we can further this collaboration as well. So please feel free to put your ideas on the table. Charles, we have a hand here.
I just want to address the obstacle of the parents not being on board. One thing that I faced when I was at a school and recognizing that the parents were definitely not on board with what I was trying to implement is to begin the conversation. I started a newsletter so that the parents can be aware of what I'm trying to do. Because many times if they don't fully understand what you're doing, it's hard for them to support whatever it is, good or bad. And so just sharing in the most positive way possible and putting those things here, this is what's happening and here's why, and putting in the council biblical references so they can see this is not just an arbitrary thing that we're trying to do, but because of this council, we're trying to implement it this way. And please share your views with us and so on and so forth, just to begin that conversation to invite them into a partnership, let them know I don't have all the answers and I am here to cooperate with you to raise the child. And so I find that they were more willing to come in, sit down, we share. We may not always find solutions to whatever we're trying to work out, but we were now in a more supportive role of each other. They were not so they're not intimidated by what I'm doing, but we were now on the same team trying to work together to solve a common problem. So that's one thing.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Dr. Beardsley for coming and also for Issei for organizing this event. And what I want to share has to do with the question that you asked and Brother Dickman was addressing of how to foster greater cooperation between, you know, self-supporting type schools and colleges and denominational schools and colleges. I think that this event is one step in that direction, because I saw, you know, the people from both types of work that are in education coming together. And as we do more of these events, and perhaps in inviting people that are also leaders in denominational schools to be part of the event, maybe breaking us up into groups, small groups, discussion groups, how are you doing this, that could help us start working together.
I'm Doug Baker with Heritage Academy. My wife, Debbie Baker, is our president, and for the last 10 years, she has been a member of the Georgia Cumberland Conference Executive Committee and also on their education board. And they have a 10-year limit for a term, and so she's just finished her term. But they asked her to continue on their education board, and they've expressed to us how much they appreciate working together with us in a cooperative effort. I would suggest it would be good for other conferences to establish those kind of relationships. That's written into the bylaws of the Georgia Cumberland Conference, that they have a member of a self-supporting institution on their executive committee, and so she served that role. Also, the Southern Union invites all of the self-supporting schools in the Southern Union to attend all of their education conferences, and it's through their efforts that we have a close relationship and work in a number of ways cooperatively in our union. For example, for a number of years, our school has trained other schools in the Southern Union in disaster response, and Together, schools in the Southern Union have responded to hurricanes and floods and so forth. So in our union, we have a pretty good level of cooperation between the self-supporting schools and the conference schools. And I feel like the model could be replicated other places.
Very good. And that's something that I'm in a position to help facilitate from my position, to encourage the organized work of education to ensure that there is adequate participation with and in collaboration with that through board membership. That's great. And the local church is the other place where I think that's where church really happens. By ensuring that there is good communication and a spirit of collaboration and not a spirit of criticism. Some of the independent ministries, I can tell you every week I get an email from one of these organizations with dirt on something that's happened somewhere in the system, and they want me to do something about it. It's just, I don't know how they get so much information, but they keep making demands, and it seems like a full-time job is just criticizing the work of the church and human flaws. And that, I do think there needs to be accountability, but that much, it seems like that's all they do is spend time criticizing the organized work of the church. And that doesn't help, I don't think. So thank you for that example.
I don't feel like I really have an answer, but I just want to say thank you for coming and for sharing. It's really exciting to me to hear what is going on in the different schools, primarily colleges, but still exciting to see the things that are happening in the colleges around the world along this line of involving the work education along in the curriculum. And what I have just kind of pictured as you were sharing was God is definitely working. You know, he's just kind of working all around on all these institutions at the same time, just kind of bringing us back to the blueprint, and that's exciting.
Yeah, the reason I focused on higher education is that the K through 12 or preschool through 12 is delegated to the divisions. So I suggest that you invite Larry Blackmer to a future one, and higher education is the responsibility of the General Conference through the accreditation process. So that's what I know about.
One of the issues that I would like to just address briefly as an educational tool here that's been presented is the use of the SDA brand. And I want this group to know what the expectation of ASI and ESAE is that we present ourselves as Seventh-day Adventist lay people who are operating institutions, not Seventh-day Adventist institutions, okay? The wording is quite critical for a variety of reasons. Number one, there is a respect for the brand, the word Seventh-day Adventist. It's copyrighted, and in order to use that in the proper way, you can get to that point. But what you need to do is you need to restructure your boards and your documents and get an agreement with the Seventh-day Adventist Church and have a majority of your board of directors who are from the Seventh-day Adventist denomination so that the Seventh-day Adventist denomination is actually in control of the organization in a majority on the board. So there's a way to do that if you want to use that route and use the name in that way. You can get to that point, but it takes quite a bit of work to get there. The better alternative probably is to simply be careful with your wording. And I know that I don't see Bridget. Where's Bridget? Oh, she's here hiding just a little bit. But I know that we've had several opportunities to look at wording and to talk with legal counsel on certain issues and to make sure that we structure the wording correctly. And actually, ESAE itself is restructuring some wording based on recent counsel that we have received so that we're tweaking the wording of our mission statement and the wording of the way we say things so that it is apparent that we are Seventh-day Adventist lay people operating things, not Seventh-day Adventist institutions. So, again, it's a wording issue, But we want to be very sensitive to that because it can make a difference when it comes to legal challenges and other things that are, you know, we live in a world where there are many legal opportunities. And I say that because you can be sued for anything by anybody as long as you can pay the lawyer. And some people do that. They're willing to pay a lawyer to do that. And there's some legal challenges on the table right now that we're dealing with that we're trying to figure out a way to go to the future that makes sense so that we're not embroiled in the same level of conversations that we are now, spending a lot of money for counsel and legal fees that should be spent on other things. So it's a very important issue. Thank you for bringing that to the table. I also would like to challenge you. Dr. Beardsley mentioned this, but I want to emphasize it. The opportunity for you to put together an article and publish it in the Journal of Adventist Education is a huge opportunity for us to show collaboration and to show encouragement. Now, please don't put together a negative article. let me just put that on the table to start with. Let's put together stuff that where we can encourage each other and show how we can work together. And so I think it's a huge opportunity for us, and I hope that some here will take up that torch and do something. Charles, we have another comment over here on this side. You do also? No, okay, right up here. So that's a very significant thing, and I thank you for offering that because it is an opportunity for us to begin to enter into the conversation in a different way.
So how do we go about doing that? Do we send an article to you?
jae.adventist.org, and the guidelines for authors, it will go in. You can submit online. It'll go through the editorial review process and the editors, Faith Ann McGarrell, there. And we would welcome that. And once it's published, then if it's a global importance, we will then translate it into Spanish, Portuguese, and French. And you can download it on your app, jae.adventist.org. You can go to the Apple Store or Google, and you can download that and search it. And I searched on work study, we don't have anything, so we need something on there. That's right.
So that was my question. What kind of stuff are you looking for?
Anything related to philosophy of Adventist education implementation. It's for teachers at either any level and administrators. So you could write on successful work study programs. You can have a section for teachers or supervisors or administrators. It can be very practical and include some pictures if you like. Okay. Yes? Well, I would welcome submissions from there, and I would suggest that you invite Larry Blackmer at a future meeting, and I'm going to recommend to him that they, at the big teachers conference that they have in 2018, that they specifically invite you and that they have a track on one of these, like work-study. I don't think anybody's doing that. And that would be an area to have the type of conversation that I heard this morning that would be really, I think, useful on a broader scale. It's going to be in Chicago next summer. I'd like to thank Randy Siebold. He did a lot of the research for me. He's at Andrews University, but formerly at Weimar. I'd like to thank you, Charles, and you, Phil, because without you two gentlemen, I would not have this presentation. It was locked up in my computer on a very, very sick computer that will have to be sent to the ICU when I leave. But by the grace of God, some magic and some counsel with our IT people there, it's there. So thank you so much. And Randy, Dr. Randy Siebold also recommended this book if you're interested in the area of work-study programs, Shop Class as Soulcraft. So I put that there as a final resource, and I thank you.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's Word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.